is the Welcome to Fatherhood Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Kelly, and I'm here to remind you, however you're listening and wherever you're listening, that as dads, we're just like moms. Except we're dads. Ha ha!
So I'm Andrew McFarlane, and I am the dad blogger behind the Papa Perspective on Instagram, interwebs, all of that stuff. And I've been doing that for about 3-4 years now.
Yeah.
And I got started with the whole blogosphere as a way to help me kind of cope with getting into fatherhood and not knowing what I was doing.
You know what's interesting about that? Because I got into podcasting to help me try to figure the same thing out.
Yeah.
So it's like, what about that moment or, you know, that phase of things just sort of made sense to you that blogging would be the best way to go about figuring this thing out?
That is a great question. For me, the reason I kind of even had that spark of idea is I was going to school for business with an emphasis in finance and marketing. And as a part of the marketing side, I had to do an internship, and I had to write blog posts for this garage storage company and things. So I was kind of familiar with the internet and creating an online business and things like that. So it was already in my mind that I could do something in this realm. Mm-hmm. So that helped. But I wanted to do my own thing, but I had no idea what I wanted to write about.
Yeah.
Fast forward like 2-3 years after school and everything, and I have my firstborn son. Yeah. And he was born with a congenital heart disease, and that added a lot of stress being our first child. Yeah. As well. Yeah. And so I was like, I've got all this bottled up stress and anxiety and kind of like this fear of the unknown of what's going to happen to my son. And I never really learned how to express my emotions. And so for me, I was like, I'm going to start writing about it. So I just started writing down the story of becoming a father, going through this experience of having a child with a congenital heart defect. And as I wrote it, it was therapeutic to kind of just get my experience on paper, just getting it down. And first off, it was very helpful for me to kind of clear my mind and get my feelings and emotions out. But then second, I was like, this is actually really fun to do.
Yeah.
And I like learning so that I can then share what I've learned.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how this has all evolved, is it's kind of funny. Like the things that I do and try to put out for other people, yeah, I hope it benefits them. But in the long run, it's benefiting
you
a lot, because I have to do a bunch of research to figure out what parenting style I want to do. Okay, this is the parenting style I want. Now I got to study that. And I go and I like nerd out and read a bunch of like data about it. Mm-hmm. And I try to take that, absorb it, and put it down for other people to read. And so that's kind of the whole thing, is the blog keeps me accountable, and it's really helped me put a huge emphasis on why parenting and why fatherhood specifically is important. And what does fatherhood look like for our generation and for the next generation?
Man, that is beautiful. And I'm glad that you brought up the point of how blogging helped you just put your feelings and emotions down on paper.
Yeah.
'Cause that's something that, in my experience, you know, before becoming a father, so going back to like my college days, one of my professors who I still keep in touch with right now. I mean, he is like a dear friend of mine, my Italian professor. He and my dormitory dean, who's another person I keep in touch with all these years. Yeah. I went to a small liberal arts college, so it was really family feel.
Yeah.
They encouraged me to write. I mean, to journal, to write, because I would express to them that, you know, sometimes I just felt so much built up anger or aggression or emotions that I just couldn't sit with someone and just openly talk to them. And so they were like, why don't you just start writing then? Just start writing whatever it's on your mind. And that was so therapeutic for me. And it was around that time that I started to developed a deeper appreciation for expressing myself through poetry. And so I just started writing all these poems.
Oh, no way. That's
cool. Yeah, dude. Just like releasing all sorts of thoughts and emotions. And if anything just caught my mind. So it got to the point that I would sit, you know, in class or just maybe even after college, just listening to a song or thinking about something. And I just hear one word or I think about one word. Yeah. And an entire stream of words just start coming to mind in poetry. And I'm just like jotting things down. The sad part about that, I was writing them in a composition notebook. Some of my earliest poetry was in a composition notebook. Mm-hmm. Can't find the composition notebook.
No.
Dude, it got lost. No.
Oh, that's brutal. That's the nice thing about the internet and the cloud and Google Docs nowadays is you just sometimes open up a Google Doc and it's just there.
Yeah. Yeah.
As long as you don't forget your password. Well, yeah.
But you know, thankfully I had started to finish the story, my thoughts were so intimate to myself that I wouldn't let anyone look at or even touch that composition notebook, because that composition notebook was like an extension of my inner being. And since I was afraid of opening up to people, I was afraid of people opening up literally the book and reading my thoughts. And so, it was a really interesting thing. So I guarded that thing with my life, which is the reason why I'm so sad that I can't find it. It got lost some way, sometime between college and grad school or something like that. But what had started to happen was, you know, life experiences, and life has a way of bringing you to your knees at times. And after something that happened to me, a car accident that I had, my perspective shifted. And then I started to open up more to people, or just opening up for the sake of opening up. And so, one of the biggest steps that I took in that journey, at the beginning of that journey, was to start making my poetry public on Facebook. And so
takes a lot of courage.
Dude, when I hit published after typing up the first one, my heart was racing.
No doubt. Terrifying.
Because I was like, oh my God, I just did that. You know what I mean? Like, people are going to listen or read this and people are going to make fun of me. I mean, all of the insecurities just came crashing down. And the response that I got from my friends and people who read it was just so overwhelmingly positive that I was just like, okay, so I can do this. So thankfully, I still have a record of some of the earliest ones, because I did post them on Facebook and I could get them back from there. Good. But some of, like, when I first started writing poetry at like 12, 13 years old, like, all of that is lost.
There's something about putting yourself out there on the internet, and there are some times where I put up a post and it's like, it's no big deal. But then there are definitely some things that I've, some blog posts that I've written, or some specific Instagram posts that I've put up, where, like, as soon as you push that publish button, you're extremely concerned about what people are going to say.
Yes.
Because people are so passionate about their own personal beliefs or about their the way they do things, and the way that they do things is their identity. For example, like a parenting style. When I put up stuff about the positive or assertive, or there's so many synonyms for the parenting mm-hmm. style that I do. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that really love the old fashioned authoritarian mm-hmm. type parenting. And sometimes I get some negative comments and mm-hmm. feedback from it. And it's like, you know, being so comfortable with yourself where you can have actual positive conversations come out of that. Just like when you're posting your poetry, you have no idea what people are going to say.
None.
And some people may say negative things, and sometimes you may hear it, sometimes you may not.
Yep.
But like trying to get over that for me is still really hard. But the thing is the positive conversations I've had after those posts carry so much more weight than the negative conversations that I've just come to the point where, like, you know what? I just got to hit publish.
And just leave it up to whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, just leave it up to whatever. And, you know, what's interesting is that now that I'm making this connection, having gone through that was instrumental in me starting this podcast. Because I remember one of the comments that I kept getting from people was, you know, once you start something like this, you're really opening yourself up to criticism of all sorts. But, you know, I had that thing to fall back on, and I didn't know that actively or intuitively at the moment. So this is just a connection that I'm literally making in the moment, but I had that to fall back on. Dude, if I could post my poetry, for as whack as it might sound or whatever the case is, but if I had the courage to put that out there and just let it sit in a public forum like Facebook, then I'm okay with people saying whatever they want to say about, you know, an episode or the podcast in general or whatever the case is. Like, it doesn't matter. People are going to say nice things and people are going to say mean things. And so that's just how the world functions, I guess.
Yeah, it's just how it works sometimes.
Transition into not that this hasn't been our conversation, because it's pretty cool that there's that similarity there. But this season, I really want to focus on the experience of fatherhood. In other words, as dads, we go through situations and we find ourselves in seasons where maybe we're feeling one thing for long period of time, or we're feeling a series of things. And I don't believe that there's ever a moment in fatherhood that you're not feeling something, you're not experiencing something. But I want to put a name to some of those situations, to some of those feelings, I mean, in particular situations. So I think it's interesting that you're basically projecting your fatherhood journey through blogging. Opportunities like this on podcasts. So you're putting yourself out there. So to start off, when you're sharing stuff out there, do you have categories? Positive stuff, neutral stuff, negative stuff? Or do you tend to lean more towards, you know, parental advice? Or are you sharing some of your personal journey as well?
I think that is a great question. And that's something that I'm personally trying to develop and focus and hone in on going into this next year. Because I feel like I've gone through a lot of personal transformations that are pushing me in a specific direction. So for example, as I started out with the whole blog, it was a lot of sharing my own personal experiences of going through what it was like having a child with a congenital heart disease. And then it went from that to me trying to just share a lot of like who I was as a dad.
Mm-hmm.
And now I feel like I'm transitioning towards a position where it's going to be giving more advice on things that work for me, and specifically what I am hoping to achieve mm-hmm. with fatherhood.
Okay.
And what that is specifically, and that goal for me, is to have a relationship, a super strong relationship with my kids 10, 15, 20 years yep. down the road.
Yep.
And that's why, you know, I've made that connection with Travis at Therapy for Dads.
Yep.
And I've worked with him on a couple of Instagram posts and blog posts and Instagram lives on just some tips and things that we can do as fathers to help ensure that we're going to have good relationships with other family members and with our kids, mm-hmm. et cetera. Because the way I was parenting when I first had, when my wife and I first had Eli, for the first couple of years, we were just kind of, we didn't really have a parenting strategy. We mm-hmm. just were like, it was all behavior focused and wanting him to do this and do that and et cetera. And then I remember this was like 2.5, 3 years ago. I mm-hmm. heard a podcast where the podcaster was telling a story about his own. I think he was telling a story about him in his 40s, and his daughter came back from a party or something, and he knew that she had smoked marijuana,
mm-hmm.
but she didn't want to tell him because she thought she was going to get in trouble. And mm-hmm. he was like, my kids are withholding information from me. Something mm-hmm. is wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, it was then at that moment, he shifted his parenting style, even kind of late in the game. He had already had a couple kids that had like been in high school, and this was one of his younger daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I got to change. I want to be the first person that my kids come and talk to and say, I want them to come to me and be like, hey, dad, I was at that party you said I could go to. Someone offered me marijuana. I tried it. And he was like, I want to be the dad mm-hmm. that's able to turn around and say, oh, how was your experience? Mm. Did you like it? Did you not like it? Would you try it again? Here, as well as, oh, okay. And if you have or haven't tried that before, and be like, this was my personal experience with X.
Mm-hmm.
And here's some of the consequences that were good. Here are some of the consequences that were bad. And just kind of act as more of a mentor
mm-hmm.
for your kids and have that relationship and treat them as another human being instead of an object that's just smaller than you that you have to provide for. And I think with that long-term relationship building in place, I hope to, as I study about this parenting style and as I put it into practice, I've noticed how it's impacted me. I've become more patient. I've been able to feel and exude unconditional love towards mm. my kids. I'm mm. not perfect at it. And there are times I still get frustrated when my two-year-old spills food all over the kitchen, but I don't explode anymore.
Yeah.
I take a deep breath. I'm like, I'm going to sit in my feelings for a second. This is very frustrating and I hate having to clean up messes. But I just turn around and go, hey, bud, it's okay. You made a mistake. You spilled some milk. Let's just go grab a paper towel and clean it up. No big deal.
Yeah, dude, you know, so this is going to sound silly. But the things that really get under our skins as parents, as dads, and the great scheme of things is really not a big deal.
Right. Like always.
Like
like your kid running 10 steps ahead of you at the grocery store. And for some reason, us parents are like, no, come back, come back, come back. You have to stand next to me. My wife and I have just been like, it's not that big a deal. Homeboy just wants to go look at some rice on a shelf and touch a box.
Yo, it's really not that big a deal. And so lately I've been finding myself in situations where my son is doing something and my wife is like, she calls him Jules. I call him Juki. And, you know, she's like, Jules. And what is he doing? He's like throwing toys down the stairs or something. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Jules, don't throw. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm frustrated too. But when I take a step back, he's just throwing toys down the stairs.
Yes.
Like he's not doing anything. I mean, yes, I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go get ready to go to the gym by 5 o'clock. So when I'm walking in the dark and I'm trying not to make any noise or whatever, if there is a toy on the stairs, I could end up making a lot of noise. But in the grand scheme of things, what he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. Isn't that the mentality? Like he's a kid. He's
playing with toys in the background. Well, dad's on a podcast.
Like he's a year and a half. So he's supposed to be doing these silly things, right? Right.
Exactly.
So why do we get so frustrated? Why does it feel so frustrating? Why does it feel so, and sometimes, and this is early on in the interest of full disclosure, like I would just get irate sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, totally. At the stupidest thing.
Yeah. Same. I would do the same thing. Well, and as I've kind of studied this, it's a lot of us adults projecting our own fears and insecurities onto our kids. So for example, we're out in public and our kids are just jumping up and down and screaming and laughing and giggling. And we're there at Barnes & Noble where everyone's trying to read while our children are doing this in the kids section because they just learned how to read a new word.
Yeah.
And we're like, shh, quiet, 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 quiet. Gotta be quiet. Stop jumping. Stop this. Because we are scared about being judged from other people that we have crazy, noisy kids.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I've had to learn to be comfortable with who my kids are and not project my own fears onto them. Where if my kids are loud, happy, and excited, and they're just expressing their emotion as such, I don't want to shut them down. Because then if they're happy that they just learned how to read a new word and they're jumping up and down and that's how they express their joy, I don't want to then turn around and be like, hush, 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 quiet, 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 and give them a negative reaction to something that's actually really positive. Because they look up to me. They look up to me as the parent to see whether what they were doing was good or bad. And if I have a negative reaction to something that actually is really positive, then it's going to be really confusing for them. And so it's a lot of just it. And what's funny is as we got a puppy at the beginning of this year, and part of the puppy training course that we followed was all positive reinforcement of you want to completely ignore your dog whenever your puppy is doing something you don't want them to do. Completely ignore it and always have treats on you and always positive reward when the dog is laying down, doing absolutely nothing and very quiet. You say, good boy, and give a treat and all of this. And so in doing that course and learning how to raise a puppy, I was like, oh, I should probably be doing this and giving lots of positive praise to my kids as well when they're doing something I want them to do. Like they're being, so for example, my two boys, when they're sitting down and playing together nicely, I see it as I walk by, I take a step back and be like, hey, you guys are doing awesome playing together. I'm so proud of you guys. You guys are great.
Yeah.
And just those little, treats of verbal appreciation when they're doing good things. Oh man, it goes such a long way. Cause then my boys come around and they're like, oh, wasn't it so great when I was playing with Blake? And then again, you were doing great. Yep. That is exactly what you should be doing. And I'm so glad that you're so kind to your brother.
Yep. Yep. So we have two cats. And again, I think it's funny that we're deriving similar lessons from how we treat our pets.
Yeah.
And how we treat our children.
Yeah.
Because I have a male and a female cat. The male cat, his name is Lucky, and he is playful and he is mischievous. I mean, but he wants a lot of attention. I have cats, bro, that really behave more like dogs than they do cats.
Nice. I love it.
So I love it. And you know, Lucky is, he just does random things just because he's a cat. Just like my son, he does random things because he's a year and a half.
Yeah.
So I look at the way that I treat Lucky and I'm just like, oh, come on, Lucky. Like you just want too much or, but I don't stop Lucky from just running around just because at that moment he felt the need to just run around and chase his own tail and do that kind of stuff. Cause he's a cat. He's supposed to do that. So I'm trying to keep myself in that mind frame. Okay. He's a year and a half. He's walking, my son, he's walking, he's talking, he is establishing his own sense of autonomy and authority. Yes. He is revealing parts of his character and all of that jazz. And so let's encourage the positive aspects of it and let's address the parts that can potentially be detrimental, even though at times I find myself saying, well, I don't like that he's doing that to me, but in and of itself, like the way in which he's expressing himself at this point can actually be used for a positive thing in the future. So I don't want to, you know, tell him don't ever do that because no, there's a situation or two where he might need to behave just like that. And that would be the right thing for him to do. In other words, I think what I'm saying, parenting is confusing as hell.
Yeah. Is it ever?
It's a trial by fire.
Yeah.
Like the expression, there is no manual or book to show you how to do this thing perfectly. There is value in that. There are books, there are obviously blogs, podcasts that can help you.
Right.
But for you to like, if I read this book and follow these steps, I'm going to be the perfect dad. That book doesn't exist.
And it won't, because every single child is different. The way I have to parent Eli, my oldest, is very different than how I have to parent Blake, my youngest, because my oldest is a lot more sensitive and feelings based. Whereas my youngest is just classic second born child. He'll jump off a cliff before he even looks, and he's just an absolute tornado. And he's not as emotionally driven as my other son. And so any sort of discipline that's like taking away a toy or doing whatever, any sort of coaching, is just, I have to phrase it and do it differently. Yeah. So, and there isn't a book on parenting that's like absolutely perfect. And then two, there isn't a book that tells you how to do it for your specific child, because every single kid is different.
Yeah. Yeah. Tap into your experience of your son being born with congenital heart disease. Because that is an area that in my work, I support a lot of parents, a lot of new parents at times that they're experiencing the best thing that happened to them. And they're in the worst possible scenario.
Yeah.
Oftentimes.
Brutal.
So I want to use your voice to give voice to that type of experience, because I don't think I've had anyone on the podcast who has spoken about an experience like that. So if you don't mind, I want to invite you into that space to be able to talk about that. So this is your firstborn. This is Eli.
Yeah.
Walk me through his birth. Did you guys know that he was coming with this problem, and sort of the feelings and mood, things that were running through your mind at that time?
Yeah. So, this goes back to, February of 2016, when I first find out that I'm going to be a dad. Mm-hmm. Super exciting. And I remember my wife, she gave me a present and I was like, this is like February. It's not Valentine's Day. Like, what's going on? And, I'm a huge hockey fan. And mm-hmm. so she got this little Anaheim Ducks onesie and I open it up and I'm like, this is a one. Oh, I'm going to be a dad. This is so awesome. And it was just like elation on cloud nine.
Yeah.
And even cooler, we're in the Utah area and I have an aunt who is one of the top OBGYNs in the entire state.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah, there's like people that plan their pregnancies around having my aunt be their doctor. Like, it's insane. Super long waiting list, everything. And my aunt is an absolute sweetheart. And we called to try to make an appointment. And they were like, you're trying to get an appointment with Missy? Yeah, good luck. And then we called my aunt and she's like, no. And she, yeah, my aunt went and told her scheduling nurse, we are getting them in like tomorrow. And so it was great. She was
thank you, auntie.
And it was so great and lots of joy and happiness and things like that. And, but then there was one of the ultrasounds mm-hmm. that she performed and she, recommended that we go, see someone else. And, we were like, okay, no big deal. Mm-hmm. This is just something we had no idea. This is our first child, first time going through this experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're having the ultrasound done. And, but this time the technician wasn't as talkative with us and the ultrasound took a little bit longer. And then all of a sudden the technician goes out. The doctor comes in, the doctor says, hey, we noticed something that could be concerning. We just don't know. We need to do an echocardiogram, which is just a more powerful ultrasound where we're going to focus on the heart. We're just wanting to double check something. And again, we're like, okay,
sure.
Yeah. We have no idea what's going on. And then we go into the University of Utah Hospital where we were recommended to go. And this was like, you know, usually an ultrasound, you're in there for what, maybe 20 minutes of them poking around and things like this.
Yep.
2 hours.
Jeez.
We were sitting in this room and we were seeing this like gray screen up all big with like red and blue and these inflows and outflows. Had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
And then we get, after that, we get pulled into like this little room and there's like a social worker and the doctor and the technician and a nurse. And we're like, this doesn't look like it's normal.
No.
And then the doctor proceeds and is like, okay, so here's what's going on from what we can see. Your son has coarctation of the aorta, which means his aorta is just pinched in this little section. So it's a fairly simple procedure. As soon as he's born, we just have to get some medication to keep certain arches and things open that are only available in the prenatal stage. And we're going to go in, we'll have to do open heart surgery.
Ugh.
And we're going to do a little incision along the aorta. And then we have some synthetic material that'll just grow as a part of him. And it'll be totally fine and normal just to kind of open up the aorta to where it should be. And the pressures in his heart should go back to normal and everything should be fine.
How did you feel at that moment when you were hearing all of that? Because I've witnessed it where doctors talk to families and this is something that from their point of view, they do this every day.
Right.
Right. So they're giving you the information and I think some of them sincerely believe that the way in which they're delivering the information is full of empathy and full of compassion and what have you, but it's sort of matter of factly for them. Like, yeah, you know, this is what we're going to do. It's simple. It's easy, but you're the one receiving it.
Yeah. So in this case, because like we had so much trust and we have so much trust in the medical doctors, like Primary Children's Hospital here in Salt Lake City is top class, mm-hmm. like top in the world for some of the things that they do. Mm-hmm. And when we heard that news, we were like, okay, sweet. Like, I mean, again, this was our first child. We had no idea what a normal experience
sure, was. Sure, yeah. Because so, this is normal to you.
Right, yeah. And the social worker was there, like, with a box of tissues. And my wife and I looked at each other and we were like, okay, we trust you guys. Like, this sounds great.
We don't need it.
And so that it was interesting. We didn't have some sort of breakdown or anything at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. Because we had no idea what to expect. They were explaining that, yes, as soon as your son is born, we're going to have to put you in a specific room in the University of Utah Hospital where there's a little window to another room. And it's like, Eli's going to be born. We have to cut the cord and basically hand him through to a nurse in the other room and get these medications started. And then we'll have to prep him for surgery and we'll take care of that. And then you guys should be able to go home.
Like fresh out the oven.
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
And so it wasn't it, like for us, we didn't know any better. But then fast forward to actual birthday. That was when everything really started to sink in. Because we had a normal experience of just continual checkups and things like mm-hmm. that. But then when the actual birth happened and we got to see him, we were elated
mm-hmm.
with emotion. But then like I got to cut the umbilical cord, everything, traditional experience. And like, it was pretty much like we got to pat him on the back and then he was gone.
Yeah.
You don't get that. Like he was born and you get to hold him on your chest.
Oh, dude.
And that's when all the emotion sunk in.
Like I'm listening to you right now, bro. And I'm like, there's a golf ball in my throat.
Yeah. And because the thing is my wife, who just went through this entire experience of giving birth, didn't get to have the reward at the end.
Yeah.
And even worse, it was like, we don't know if he's going to survive.
Yeah.
And so I actually, after they got the medications and things started, they gave me the green light to go ahead and go get like sanitized and sterilized. I had to like wash my hands for like 20 minutes,
mm-hmm.
if at least it felt like 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then go in and I got to hold his finger and be with him for like 15 minutes, which I still remember like it was yesterday.
For sure. For sure.
Like absolute incredible experience. And I took a photo with me and him in there, and it's mm-hmm. one of my favorite photos with mm-hmm. him. We got to then, after my wife was good to go, he had the medications. He was put into like this plastic box on wheels that had all the machines and things hooked up to him, because he had to get transported to from the University of Utah Hospital to Primary Children's into the cardiac intensive care unit, where they would do all the surgery prep and medications and things. And it was over there where they then could do another echocardiogram on his heart directly mm-hmm. on him, because mm-hmm. they were having to go through the womb, which made it harder to see everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that they found a second issue. And they found out that he had hypoplastic left heart syndrome as well, which simply means the left side of his heart wasn't developed as well. And that's when we had a student doctor. It's a student hospital.
Yeah.
And so a student doctor came, and that night, like this all, the birth and everything happened around like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
This was now like 9 o'clock at night, 9:10. And the student nurse comes in and delivers just a bomb, like not very good bedside manner, very just matter of fact. And was like, okay, so your son has coarctation of the aorta and hypoplastic left heart syndrome. Generally speaking, with this surgery, there's X amount percent of chance that they'll survive. And we're going to have to most likely combine the two bottom chambers of his heart into one chamber. It's a 3-part surgery, and he's going to probably die when he's like 20 or 30. That's usually what happens. And we're like,
what?
You what?
The...
And I'm like, my wife just gave birth to this child, and you can't deliver that like kindly or softly. I know it's a bad story to sell, period. but you could at least like wrap it up and give me this ugly present with a bow on top. Like it was, and that was our start into it. But I write about my whole experience on my blog, but fast forward through 7 days of hell of back and forth, because the cardiologist actually, they were supposed to operate within a couple days of him being born, but they didn't operate for like 10 days because the cardiologists were going back and forth of like, his heart's working, but it's small. And we need to figure out, are we going to do the big surgery? This decision we make affects this child's life.
Mm-hmm. Period. Period.
And at the end of the day, we had a amazing surgeon who came in, and like surgeons, these humans are something else. Like he came in and like, you know, sometimes surgeons can be perceived as arrogant or cocky. Yes. And I'm like, doesn't matter to me, because they have to be. They have to be the guy that says, I'm the best at this, and I'm going to do this perfectly, and this child is going to survive because of me. And I'm like, give you all the ego you want, because if you do it right, then you are worth the millions of dollars I'm seeing hit my insurance right now.
And my son gets to come home with me.
Exactly. And so the surgeon goes in, and he's like, I'm going to go in, and I'm going to fix the coarctation. That pinched aorta has to get fixed, period. The other piece, I'm going to check the pressures inside of his heart, and I'm going to make a game time decision after that if he needs to go to a 3-chamber heart. If he goes to a 3-chamber heart, again, he has 2 following surgeries he'll have to do, and his life expectancy is cut in a third to like a third. Longest day of our life. All they do is we go in the morning with him, and we basically give him a hug and wave to the anesthesiologist and the doctors, and they give us a pager and they tell us what happens.
Jesus, dude.
Super long 8-hour, 10-hour day or whatever the surgery was. And we come back in and the surgeon sits us down and is like, the surgery went perfectly. And we just felt this huge weight off of our shoulders. Man. Like, seriously, it feels like you're constantly squatting 300 pounds everywhere with you. And that was just thrown off of our shoulders immediately.
Yeah. Yep.
And he said, I ended up leaving him a 4-chamber heart because his heart was doing really well.
Wow.
And I mean, that was just kind of like the end of leg one of our journey. The next like 4 years, like we went home with him with a feeding tube through his nose into his stomach. Mm-hmm. He had to be on oxygen for like a year. So we had oxygen tanks that we would carry with us everywhere for a year. And medications that we had to give to him 3 times a day for 3 years. But yeah, like I'm speeding through a lot of trauma and stress and therapy sessions that I've had to go through to get to this point in a short podcast. But now today we had his checkup like 6 months ago, and the doctor was like, his heart is basically normal. And there's no way we could have predicted this. He is doing wonderfully. And we were just like over the moon.
How old is Eli now?
Eli is now 5 years old and he looks like he's 8. They're like, he's growing like a weed. Kids that have heart conditions aren't supposed to be this tall, this big, have this much success. He's not supposed to, but he is. And we're like, sweet. I guess all of the macaroni and cheese and chicken nuggets we're feeding are good. But yeah, I mean, it's a big... I had to, and strangely enough, through this experience of child one and child two, I found out that I get postpartum depression. My wife doesn't. I do because of all the stresses of being a dad and adding children to your family and all this responsibility and things. And am I going to do a good job and all of that? And so I'm a huge mental health advocate of like, hey, you know, if your arm's broken, you're going to go to a doctor.
Yep.
If something seems wrong, like you're not, like you're constantly sad or you're constantly anxious or something, just go talk to a professional. Yep. Just talking to a professional therapist, counselor, anything it's such a positive experience, mm-hmm. and they just give you such healthy mental tools to work through these experiences. Mm-hmm. Absolutely unbelievable, mm-hmm. incredible experience.
Again, like you said, you left a lot of stuff out because we're in a short podcast, but
yeah.
just to be able to highlight these moments of how, I mean, I'm listening to you and I'm just like, I felt like I was living it with you. You know what I mean? Like I can't even imagine what these parents are going through. And as a parent myself, when I am with families in those situations, it's hard to find the right things to say because our experiences are different, but I get the pain of what it would be like for me. I understand it,
yes.
you know, to that degree, but can't experience the emotions to the degree that these families who are actually in it are experiencing it.
Right.
Did you feel throughout this process that you were sort of like a secondary person? Or were you also considered as important in terms of what was happening? And when the medical team came to talk to you, were they addressing you as equally as mom, or was it mostly mom and then you were sort of in the background somewhere?
We made sure we were there early. So it came to a point where after a few days of staying at the hospital, we were close enough to the hospital where like a 20-minute drive where we just ended up going home every single day. So we were at the hospital by 7 a.m. every single day because we knew that they did rounds, mm-hmm. as in like all the nurses and doctors would get together and talk about each child's situation in the CICU. And so we were there every single day. And when the doctors talked to us, I felt like it was pretty equal as they addressed both of us. And I kind of credit that to how my wife and I carry ourselves. I feel like over the years, we've really tried to work together as equals. Mm-hmm. And we feel, it's not that we actually do share the load. That's a big part of it. But we feel like we equally share the load of every responsibility in our home.
Mm-hmm.
As far as parenting goes, like mm-hmm. I help change stinky diapers and put kids to bed sometimes. And for us, we figured that it's our bedtime routine is way more successful when just one parent does it. So sometimes we take turns, but we don't keep score of who takes turns, yeah. et cetera. And so because of the way that we carry ourselves, yeah. I feel like that, that really helped make it so that people referred and talked and interacted to us as a unit, which we really appreciate as well.
So we have about 10 minutes or so left. Mm-hmm. And there are so many follow-up questions that I have about your experience, but
We'll have to do a part two.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do a part two because seriously, you know, like I said, my day job is to support families in all sorts of situations, ranging from something that's not so devastating to the mm-hmm. absolute most devastating, in this case, mm-hmm. watching your child die and you can't do anything about it.
Yes.
And everything else in between.
Yes.
The past 2 weeks for me personally have been high intensity stuff that has ended in the worst possible case scenario. So, you know, So yeah, we'll definitely have to do a part two just to be able to get in the weeds of your experience so far, because it's important for, I think, one of the areas where a lot of improvement can be done is in the parental courses space.
Yeah.
Where, and I never went through one of those courses because when we were about to, COVID happened and then everything just shut down.
Right.
And so my wife and I, we never got to take any parental classes. But from my understanding, I don't know, and maybe there is. So if anyone is hearing this and if you know, please correct me, but I don't think there's an emphasis in these classes to help set the expectation for parents that, hey, we're all hoping for the best case scenario. However, it is not unlikely that even though all the ultrasounds, all of the anatomy scans and all of that stuff has turned out perfectly, once your child is born,
yes,
that all can change in a matter of moments.
Blink of an eye.
You know what I mean? So I don't know if there is any class that sort of prepares people, parents, in that way, because the expectation is, we want you to be happy. We want you to be joyful. We want you to really be prepared for the best day of your life.
Right.
But that best day of your life, dude, can turn into such a nightmare so quickly.
Yes.
And so giving voice to fathers whose experience has been that is one of those areas that I feel like I'm leaning more towards, you know, in future iterations of this podcast, because I think it's important for those stories to be told and to be shared on a public forum for other dads who might be in the process of expecting their first children or even a second child or a third. Like, things can change in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. And I think what you're doing is absolutely fantastic, because us dads, it's the experience is very different for a mom versus a dad. And coming into fatherhood, there's a lot of different ways that we handle that and think about it. And what are we going to do with fatherhood? And especially we had that happen to us in the blink of an eye. Okay. Oh, it's like, okay, we go in for an ultrasound. We found out ahead of time. Sometimes parents don't, but, we had one issue, but it turned out there were two issues, and we found out the second issue in the blink of an eye. Like, and so, the best thing that I think those parenting classes and courses, and even just in preparation for your first child, one of the things that I wish I had done is maybe gone to therapy beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And even just if had I had specific mental tools on how to express emotion properly, how to handle emotion properly, how to handle negative thoughts properly. I have tool sets now.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I had to learn those after the fact, after damage had already been done.
Yeah.
And I wish I had gone back and done more prep work for myself.
Yeah.
Not how I'm going to parent, but how I should properly respond to situations.
Yeah. And yes. And the difficulty in that is that you don't know what situation you're going to find yourself in.
There's no way to know.
There's no way to know, you know? Dude, several weeks ago, I was working late and I went to give a family something. And as I'm walking in the CICU, cardiac intensive care unit, I see a woman sitting outside and she is crying. But I see her and I'm like, no, she looks too old to be the mother of a patient. So she must be like a grandparent.
Right. Yeah.
So I stopped by and I talked to her and she says, yes, my grandchild just passed. So my daughter's back there. She's distraught. Could you please, you know, go back there and help support? And this was this couple's first child.
Yeah.
And the child was healthy, healthy pregnancy. Mom just kept saying, I had a perfect pregnancy. Baby was born. And a couple of hours later, something happened that the baby was not responding well and got transferred to my hospital and the baby passed. And it's not because of anything the parents did. It's not because anything.
Yeah.
It just happened, yeah. You know? And I know this is a really somber conversation, but this is a reality that families go through.
Yes.
This is something that is true for millions of families who are simultaneously the best thing that happened to them is the worst possible thing that could happen to that best thing that just happened to them. And the devastation of, you know, what it means for the family, what it means for the parents, what it means for the mom is something different than what it means for dad, even though for both mom and dad, it means something similar. But mom is experiencing it in a different way. Dad is experiencing it in a different way. And I know in conversations that I've had with dads, some fathers don't feel like they can express themselves.
Yes.
Or open up because they have to be strong for mom. And so there's yes. all of these complexities where, you know, dude, you need to also find some way to take care of what you're experiencing. So I find myself Correct. Often validating dad, like, no, you have your experience as well. It's a given. You didn't carry the child. It's a given. You didn't feel the child in your body the way that mom does. But that is still the best part of you that is wrapped up in this child. And so you are feeling the pain. So there's all of these layers to, you know, what I've witnessed parents go through, particularly what I've witnessed fathers go through.
Yeah.
And again, that's one of the reasons why I think I want to bring the voices of these fathers into the conversation. Because it's devastating. And it's not something that's, you know, is fun and welcome. It's not.
No. And yeah, but it's real. It's what real. Actually happens. And that's the thing that I've had to learn over time. And I still have a hard time with, because again, I've got 25 plus years of me thinking that it's not okay to cry. And I'm only within the last, again, like 3 years having like gone through this parenting strategy shift.
Yeah.
Learning how to better myself.
Even. Yeah.
And yeah. It's crazy, but it's so healing and building. One of the things that's happened to me within recent years is just this complete shift of trying to build real and close friendships, especially with other men. I'm mm-hmm. not good at it. I don't mm-hmm. know what it's like to have guy friends, really, because like my dad didn't really have guy friends growing up, so I didn't have that example. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to kind of make it up as I go and mm-hmm. trying to figure that out and be vulnerable and real with other guys mm-hmm. has been difficult mm-hmm. but extremely rewarding, and especially talking about doing things like this and sharing my experience has been therapeutic, and I'm just grateful for the opportunity to share my story, and hopefully it helps other people.
I want you to take the next 3 minutes, 4 minutes, however long it takes you, from your vantage point in life and history right now, project a little bit, real or imaginary, what the world might be like by the time Eli and Blake are young men who are stepping into their own and would be going out into a world that will be both welcoming and hostile towards them in many ways. What is a dad wisdom that you can share for your sons right now to help them navigate some of the challenges that they will face once they become young men?
Man, that is a deep question. But the two things that came to mind are two things that I'm really trying to work on myself and things that I hope that I can show them. And it's twofold. One is to have a high emotional intelligence and recognize that emotions are okay.
Mm-hmm.
That emotions are not good or bad. They are solely indicators
mm-hmm.
of what's going on in your life and how to use them appropriately. And then second is the importance of relationships in your life.
Mm.
Because when life is good, you want to share that mm-hmm. with people. When life is absolutely terrible and at its worst,
mm-hmm.
you also want to share that with people mm-hmm. and surround yourself with people that'll help lift you up and support you in those hard moments.
Yeah.
And I feel like it doesn't matter how much money you make, doesn't matter what your job is, doesn't matter how big your house or what car you drive, what matters and what you take with you are your experiences and the relationships that you had with people. When you look back on your life, you want to say, man, that was a fun ride. And I had a lot of fun with the people that came with me. And as long as my boys can surround themselves with friends and people that really care about them and not any of this high level acquaintance or mm-hmm. fake relationship things, but have real genuine friends with mm-hmm. them, I think would be absolutely wonderful. And I hope that I can be one of those people for
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Well said, my friend. Well said. Listen, Andrew, tell people where they can find your blog.
Yeah, you can find me on TikTok or Instagram at Papa Perspective. And you can also find my blog, papaperspective.com, where I'm going to be way more active nowadays. Fatherhood, and sometimes I like to mix it up, and I a hobby of mine is DIY projects, so I throw some of my random crazy projects up there every once in a while, like just recently finishing some permanent DIY lights on my house for the Christmas season. Love that. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Sweet. Again, thank you for sharing your experience. Thank you for making the time to chat with me this morning, and really looking forward to part two of our conversation where we can talk a little bit more about a really real experience of fathers. But thank you so much, man. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.